Too short of 300 shows I've done since December 2012, but we're very happy to have Barbara Randall with us again today. We got to catch up and meet in person for the first time. What was it, Barbara, about 3 years ago?
I don't know. I don't know, Jeff. It's a bit of a blur.
Yes. I really want to thank you for taking the time, and I'd like to thank someone whose name I'm only going to mention once, Iris Rae Nunn, who my last interview was with.
Yes.
And I have to thank her for getting you and I in touch.
Well, I think we have a lot to thank Iris for. She's quite a warrior woman, and in an era when we need the women to stand up and speak up and speak out for the earth. And Iris does that with as much courage as any woman I've ever known.
Yes.
So, you know, if I'm part of that that thread of connections, that's kind of the way life unfolds, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you meet one person and it links us to another, and every person hopefully is thinking along the lines right now on the planet of what can we contribute.
Absolutely.
And women especially have to do this together.
Yes.
So it's always a great honor to think that I'm connected to Iris in that. You know, in the spirit of being in service.
That is so cool.
So that's good to know.
Yes. And just to set the stage, Barbara is the, correct me if I'm wrong, you are the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, who was a very well-known,
yes,
very well-known, loved and respected elder from the Central Desert. He was one of the custodians of Uluru, the big sacred red rock. And it was through my attempt to bring a hand-painted rock to him, but I didn't get to the Central Desert before he passed away, and then you and I were brought together to meet, I think because of our friend Kayleen from Magnetic Island made that connection. And
yes,
and you have such a very unique perspective on a lot of stuff relating to Australia and the First Nations Australians and the complexities of all of this in the world of today, both in general and specifically, which I wanted to focus not so much on the specifics, but on the more sort of generalized things. But I've got a few topics to ask you about, and I fully acknowledge that you,
sure,
you're not a social psychologist, you're not an anthropologist or anything like that. You're a very loving and aware human being with connections down under and globally, and you're originally from America, and so that's why I think you're in a unique position to. I'd love to hear what you have to say when I ask you about some of these things. But first, I wanted to just ask briefly if you could sort of tell what, just kind of in a nutshell, who was Uncle Bob and what his mission and legacy was and is now, and how that relates to and complements and or differs from your own mission and legacy going on right now.
Oh, well, that's a big question. I don't know that I've ever thought of my husband in a nutshell.
but
because he was so expansive in the way he lived, in the legacy he left, and I think in his what seems to be his destiny that he realized throughout his life. My husband was an Aboriginal person who was born around the 1930s at a time when this country was not considered the lucky country to a lot of Aboriginal people here. It was a time of great change, and he, in essence, was destined to be a bridge between two ways of being, an ancient, what you might call a wisdom way, a way of the indigenous peoples of the planet, and a new way that came into this country and into many countries through colonizers who showed up And all of a sudden, everything changed, and it changed pretty much around the world rather violently. So my husband was part of that. He was taken away from his family and his land in 1938 because it was government policy at the time to remove children who were had white fathers, typically black mothers and white fathers. And my husband was one of those children. And so he was removed under a policy, the intent of which was to assimilate these children and make them white. So making them white was considered better for them. And the government assigned a protector, an Aboriginal protector, and had police patrols that literally went around throughout the country, but my husband was in the Northern Territory in the bush, and simply took the children by force, often at gunpoint. So my husband was taken away. He was removed and put into an institution that the government and the, you could say, the colonizers deemed better for him. And the result of that was he was living under the threat of losing his identity as an Aboriginal person. For many reasons, my husband didn't do that. He retained his identity as an Aboriginal person, and he never bought into the conditioning that tried to change him to the extent that he believed it was better to be white, or at least brown, anything but black, anything but Aboriginal. He never bought into that. And in fact, he became a very strong proponent for Aboriginal rights, for Aboriginal identity. He became a teacher. And I met him as an elder, at which point, you know, he had evolved to the point where he truly had transcended all of the humanness that can respond to trauma. And many people referred to him as the Dalai Lama of Aboriginal Australia, I think simply because it was quite evident in his presence that not only did he carry wisdom, but he carried so much love and so much authority over his own human frailties, if you will. He had gone beyond that, and he was a model for many people and a teacher for many people.
Yes. May I ask, without interrupting your train of thought, you mentioned yesterday that you thought, correct me if I'm wrong, that he was the only...
Your voice is fading, Jeff.
You said that he was the only Indigenous person that you've known that seemed to not have any kind of residual or unspoken hostility against the quote-unquote white man? Something like that?
Well, let me clarify that a little. It's not that he didn't have anger or the normal human emotions.
Yes.
It's that he didn't choose to live by them.
Ah, yes.
And so they rarely raised their presence.
Yes.
In what he said, what he actioned. But no, he was very human with all the full spectrum of human emotions. But he simply had transcended it so that, you know, in his words, when people were to say to him, "Uncle Bob, why aren't you angry?" he would say, "Because I don't choose it."
That shows a very high degree of spiritual evolution. And also, I mean, pragmatically, being angry is probably, if your goal is to actually help things be better, anger might have its place now and then, but as a chronic state to be in, it's probably completely you know, counterproductive.
Well, I would agree with what you're saying. In fact, he said something similar in an absolutely beautiful interview that he gave. And he said, in essence, and this is paraphrased, anger has its place. Quite often, you know, it will warn you and protect you if you're being threatened. But it also can overwhelm, can overcome you, and you don't want to become that anger.
Exactly. It can be like a poison that kind of taints everything.
That's
and,
right.
Regardless.
And he had the direct experience of that anger as a young man. And rightly so. I don't know that I would have done any better in his position.
How could you not?
Yes. Sorry,
I'm sorry. How could you be stolen from your family and not feel anger at the people doing it?
Well, the stealing was only the part of it. The stealing was, that was dramatic and traumatic in and of itself, but then the way he was treated. There were no substitute mothers and fathers and family members. There was no connection to culture and land. He was prohibited from speaking his language, from doing his ceremonies, from going through his initiations. They took away pretty much everything that gave him his identity, but the one thing they couldn't take away was his inner knowing. They couldn't touch it for whatever reason. He had an inner knowing that was so strong and perhaps, and I believe, based on his stories of over and over again, I believe that, well, first of all, he had a destiny. He must have come in as someone who had the capacity to endure this.
Yes.
And be who he became. But also, always spoke about the love of his many mothers. He always spoke about the freedom on Mother Earth. And so, from what I could see and tell from his stories, that love was so unconditional. And it ran so deep at such a critical time of his beginnings of life when he was simply forming his identity that it was indelible. And he never lost that memory and that access to that within himself, because that love, in the way it's done traditionally, it reinforces your self-identity, not as just a physical person on the planet, but as a beautiful expression in your own uniqueness, a beautiful expression of creation.
Wow, that is so beautiful. And you know, I told you before, the first time, like, I had heard of him ever since 2000, when I gave that painted rock to someone that gave it to Bob, and then you showed it to me. That was so cool. But the first time I ever saw him speak was on that John Pilger documentary called Utopia. And I just, like, I fell in love with his spirit, because he just radiates in how he looks and talks and his words exactly what you just said, an unconditional love of, you know, it just, even if, I think he's someone that, even if no words were spoken, you could just be around him and see and get his energy and be healed and grow and evolve from that. I really feel that he was, it's just like you said, a very unique person that was maybe called back from another galaxy, you know, to come back for this incarnation here. But yeah, that is so cool. Well, look, so now, how does your own, you're part of your work now, as I understand it, is both to carry on with Bob's work and legacy, and then also your own too, which are both quite similar and parallel, but yet different, partially if for no other reason that you're a woman. But what would be the complementary aspects of that?
Well, I guess the way I see it is that the first thing that comes to mind is something that Bob said, and something he actually wanted to add to the credits of the Kundini film. He said, "No one can own knowledge, but it's the elders who are keepers of knowledge." And his entire legacy is a body of knowledge that he put together throughout his life in service to the children, the children's children, to all the future generations, and to the entire planet, and really the universe, because he considered himself a child of the universe.
Yes.
The connections in that way of being, such that you identify as carrying the energy of the superconsciousness of creation. Every life form carries that. That identification gave him that sense of connection to everything that there is. And so when you live in that space, then there's a longing, a striving, just a way of being that can't help but do everything in service to everything that there is. And that's what he did. Now, Bob, you know, he had his lifetime, and the time came when he was called back. He was called back into that rebirth, into the spiritual. And as hard as it was, I also carry a belief that there's an intelligence within the superconsciousness of creation, that when we live in that same spirit of service, when we have that knowing, even if, you know, to whatever level we struggle in our own humanity of emotions that come up, even with all the grief, the years of grief after he passed, of simply missing him, I also believe that everything happens for a purpose, especially now. We're all alive for a purpose. And my part is unique to me, just as your part is unique to you, because we all have that co-creative capacity. That's part of being alive, is that we're creative beings and we create in different ways. And hopefully, ultimately, it's in service to the oneness, to the ours-ness, to all things, all beings. And so here I am, left with what I consider a responsibility for this body of knowledge, and what Bob considered a responsibility. And he said very clearly to me, "It's going to be up to you to get these teachings out to the world." He said that right at his end time. And, you know, as elders do, this wasn't a question, "Will you?" It was simply, "This is how it is." He always knew why I came. And so this is what I consider is what I'm holding. Now, as a woman, I have a unique way of holding a body of knowledge or anything else in life that comes into my realm of responsibility. And that requires all that we learn about, how do I say this, Granny's Law, basically. What is the responsibility of a grandmother? I'm a grandmother many, many times over. And in my knowing as a grandmother, it means that I live with the responsibility of nurturing, hopefully informed by courage, by faith, by an intelligence of that lies within the connection to my own guardian ancestors with a wisdom even such that, and wisdom is that, it's that knowing that transcends the humanness that gets in the way. Doesn't go into that. Doesn't fall, your choices don't fall prey to that. You might feel an anger or a resentment or a negative feeling or a weakness or a fear, but you don't give it any energy. And instead, that wisdom can step in.
Yes.
And so I consider my responsibility, I take it very seriously. And I can feel inside myself, Jeff, that this is what I'm meant to do. I lived decades in my life and got a lot of flack for it from other people. Oh, Barbara, she hasn't found herself. She's just floating around doing this and doing this. And I don't know that I was floating. We don't need to talk quite about that. But I do know that I have a much different response to my life now, because I feel this maternal sense of protecting his legacy, of honoring his wishes, and also of providing, facilitating access to these teachings to the best of my ability.
Yes.
In as wide a way as beyond what I can even imagine, because in my heart of hearts, I do believe that the planet has forgotten a lot of these teachings. I've seen and experienced many, just hundreds and hundreds of people around the world who are asking for these teachings. They're asking for them.
Yes. Well, may I ask you this? Would you say that the essence of Bob's teaching, which, and also yours, which, correct me if I'm wrong, centers on the idea of being of service to all of life and the sense of responsibility, is that sort of a modern interpretation of ancient Dreamtime law, a central core elements of that, that's always been there?
It's certainly part of it. Because, you know, it's like the African saying, when you pray, move your feet. And Bob always said, you can think about it, you can talk it, but it doesn't mean anything unless you action it.
Yes.
And so it's being in service is the underlying
manifestation.
However, it's not the whole story. Because, you know, the missionaries were in service.
Yes, to what? Their belief. Now, I mean, that's where it gets really tricky, doesn't
it? Well, you know, I just listened to hours and hours of interview from the National Library. Interviewed one of the sisters that was on the mission. And she talked about the children and her time at Otford when they sent the kids down south, when they evacuated Croker Island and sent the kids down south. And I truly believe it was almost horrifying sometimes to hear her perceptions of what the kids experienced, because they certainly were not my husband's perceptions.
Yes.
But it was her deepest belief that the kids were happy and that a lot of them were better off. And that to the best of her ability, she provided that teaching and that education, that enculturation in knowing how to wash themselves and all those things that the colonizers valued. What she didn't have was both sides of the story. She didn't hear my husband's story or the other children. She didn't have knowledge and understanding of that other side of the story, and that's essential for full understanding. But in her heart of intentions, I felt she was good-hearted to the best of her ability.
Isn't that such a huge paradox, that such dire consequences can be wrought on people out of someone doing what they think is best. I don't know. It's hard to get your head around that sometimes, how much of that there is in our history.
The shocker is that this was her belief decades after she stopped working with these children.
Wow, now that's freaky.
Even when she had access to the other side of the story.
Ah, yes.
That there's still a
denial.
She's still founded in her understanding of that perspective of the colonizers.
Well, she'd have to be, because if she questioned it, that it might undermine her belief in her whole life.
Well, I think that's a point well taken. And Bob even says in one of his interviews that about sorry debt.
What does that mean?
That Australia simply doesn't want to know the truth.
No. It's too painful. I mean, it's too, well, does the word schizophrenia, could that come into this equation somehow? Like a collective.
I'm not thinking so, Jeff, because that's a condition where it's almost as if the synapses aren't all connected with the spirit.
An organic connection.
This is a different scenario altogether. This is where pride and envy and ego override one's capacity to be humble, to listen, to be present, to consider that they might not be right about something.
Yes.
Schizophrenia, I grew up with schizophrenic kids, some of them. And that's a different thing altogether. There's no volition in that.
Yes, yes, I understand. This is a higher level of dysfunction.
It's a more conscious level.
Yes.
Of dysfunction. There's a potential here for self-help.
Yes.
And change.
Yes. But
the question is, you know, like David Suzuki said to my husband many decades ago when they worked together at a university. He came into Bob's office one day and he said, "Bob, how do we change attitudes?"
Hey, I can't tell you how cool it is talking with you, because you're extraordinarily clear in your ability to sort of conceptualize and articulate these core kind of like aspects of what's going on. But in the interest of time, may I first thank you for being such a beautiful spirit and all your work and stuff. But let me ask you a couple of these kind of things that relate. Like, these are some kind of things that have been bouncing around in my head for a while. And there's a lot of especially in Australia, but other places too, there's, you know, we've got, whenever I try to draw a contrast between the sort of split in the human world of today, I sort of draw a contrast between indigenous modes of living and living in what we call civilization, which literally means living in cities. So you've got indigenous, where traditionally people lived quite simply, relatively close to nature, with a minimum of materialistic things, but with very highly evolved spiritual and psychological awareness and knowledge. And I think that's the majority of how all people have lived throughout the majority of what we call history. And then at least in this incarnation of civilization, which, you know, there may be other ones before, but this one that might go back its roots, you know, 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000 years or something like that, but it's increasingly built on an artificial material world with increasing technology and increasing kind of like sociological systems that are kind of forms of enslavement, or, you know, like global capitalism. And then you add in all the technological advances and stuff. What I wanted to ask is, is it possible for anyone to still be truly indigenous in the world of today? especially if David Attenborough's film crew has discovered them?
I think we have to be careful about semantics.
Yes.
And language, because it's almost as if the definitions are a result of what's happening in the world, what's unfolding in the world.
Yes.
And is it really important to be indigenous, or is it important to be connected to Mother Earth?
Yes. Well, this is a very good point. Very good point.
So, when my husband referred to indigenous, what he simply was referring to, because he came from a different era, he was born in the bush naked. He walked around naked on the planet with completely different structure of social structure within his family and tribe. And when he referred to indigenous, he referred to the people who were originally on this land.
Yes.
The black people.
Yes.
And he made a distinction between the black people and the white people. And that's rather apparent.
Clearly.
Anybody who wasn't black, who followed, don't have their roots in this land. Now, some of that is changing. And he did, it's part of the cultural teachings, but the first line of connection and relationship in Aboriginal way, from what he explained, is the totemic connection, which connects you to the totemic ancestors whose energy is in the land, depending on where you're conceived and born. Now, he said to white people, red people, didn't matter what color they were, if you were born here, you have a totemic connection, but you got to find out about it. And that in itself isn't enough to call you indigenous, because with that definition that he gave of indigenous, he also recognized the ethos of living. Of living in the hoursness, of living close to Mother Earth, of actioning your responsibility in honoring, in singing up your totemic ancestors. You've got a lifetime of responsibility to your relations. And just because you're born that doesn't mean you live it. You've got to walk it. So, you know, to argue about the term indigenous, it's not that important to me. Some people say, oh, we're all indigenous to Mother Earth. Oh, yeah. But where's your action? Where's your knowledge? Where's your humility? Where's your caring for country behaviors and actions on behalf of those who follow you, the generations to come?
Yes.
Where's that?
That is so beautiful, what you just said, because it reminds me of what I often say about people talking about, they're emphasizing if you're black or if you're white, or, and I go like, but look, those are really emphasizing the differences between people, that ultimately we're all people, you know, or, you know, depending on our how we act, how we relate with each other in the world, kind of defines how much of true people you actually are. If being human being is that true spiritual definition of all the sort of, I mean, it's kind of like, I think what you're defining with your legacies is what it truly means to be people. You know, what that has traditionally meant in terms of kinship and community and responsibility and sharing and stuff like that, and emphasizing all these differences. And sometimes some of it can become kind of like a marketing category too, for like tourism and stuff, you know, and it's just like, I think that for people to, I love what you said.
Well, you know, I think it's kind of poetic that you mentioned marketing, because I have great compassion for so much of humanity who's been raised by marketers, who's been brought up and indoctrinated
by television,
by everything that is other than the original instructions to humanity. So, you know, it's not that all of us necessarily have to learn specific ceremonies or practice Aboriginal culture in the way that Bob grew up with it, in the details. It's not that at all. But it is that we are in a place and time where we're being confronted with the results of all of the marketing to humanity of our identities as something other than what my husband knew as his identity.
And
I don't even know what the name for it is.
And we're being asked to...
Sleepwalking identity.
Yes.
It's lost the spiritual strength. It's a spiritual problem, identity problem.
Yes, we're being asked...
Because of that, we've lost our connection to the earth and to each other and everything. And so we try to connect to things that are mechanical and that are in the physical without any spirit.
And we have to buy them, too.
Yes, we have to buy them, and money's part of that whole story.
It is. Well, look, let me jump to another topic. This is so cool, your ability to just sort of crystallize these huge things into one little drop there. You were talking, when we spoke yesterday, about something you had said before, that there's kind of a twofold thing happening with a lot of the indigenous elders now, that are, some of them are of the school that now's the time to possibly share esoteric secret knowledge or wisdom that had potentially only been available to high-level initiates because of the urgency of where we are in the world and blah, blah, blah. It's a sort, you know, and then others that think, well, you know, nah, people have to, like, we can't just hand it out. We've got to, people have to sort of earn and show that they've, that they're worthy of having this knowledge passed on. And I know even all that's a generalization, but that's yet another one of the sort of the complexities of, and I can see both sides of that.
And I can too, Jeff. It breaks my heart when I meet an elder and I see that no one's listening to him or her. And I see them aging and not necessarily being cared for and treated properly. And when I say the word elder, I do it with, I don't know, it's not even a real word traditionally.
Exactly.
But I'm talking about someone with a body of knowledge, someone with stories, someone with knowledge and wisdom that is not being utilized in the way it was meant to, in keeping with their responsibilities to life.
Because part of it is to be able to pass it on to an appropriate torch.
You can't pass it on if the whole container through which it was always handed down has been distorted.
Yes.
Because what you've got is in that contamination, that contamination then is an overlay on the person you're passing it to. There are so many incidences of appropriation in this country. I can't even begin to explain the extent to which appropriation happens. And what that means is that knowledge is always, as Bob said, knowledge is responsibility. And if that knowledge isn't, as it always was, overseen by the grannies, by the old people, then it can be misused and used under the influence of that contamination. So what is that contamination? That contamination is where profit,
yes,
whether it be ego profit or money profit,
or both,
overrides the discernment of the elder. Because now that young person has control of that body of knowledge. The elder isn't consulted anymore. Sometimes they don't even have legal copyright, even of their own words, their own image, their own voice, their own everything. They've lost the legal copyright because they didn't know that if they signed that paper, they'd lose it. My husband, that happened to him over and over again. Because it's incomprehensible in his traditional way that someone else can own those things.
Yes, it's diabolical. It's diabolical in a way. Well,
the problem is, it's less about legal ownership and more about who's responsible for that body of knowledge now. And how can you possibly remove it from the governing wisdom of the elders to disseminate that knowledge in a certain way, in certain timing? And, you know, I heard, what's his name? Oh, I've forgotten his name now, but he basically said, elders don't keep 4-4 time.
That's good.
I love that.
Yes.
It's so true. They're so connected to life that there's a rhythm that coincides with the symphony of life, and it's never the same twice. That doesn't mean you can take a body of knowledge and compartmentalize it, hand it over to a young person for their control, and take it away from that beautiful finesse of the elder who knows how to keep the orchestra in harmony.
Yes, it might be like playing a symphony orchestra, the difference between hearing it live and hearing it coming out of your telephone. But how about this? Let me ask you what I think about...
Not only that, but then you've got the overlays of that energy of contamination when it's touched by the greed, you know, the money or the ego.
The taint factors.
Well, that energy, that dark cloud, it permeates everything. It disrupts the natural flow that's in the light, basically.
Yes. Well, look, let me ask you this. How about this? A lot of this knowledge, I'm asking this as a question, but in my mind, a lot of this knowledge is, it's not just la-di-da, feel good, superfluous stuff about stuff that doesn't really matter. Some of it might have to do with our ability to maintain our proper connection with life on this planet. You know, I mean, truly cosmological things like that. And if it's not maintained properly, or if the proper multidimensional song lines aren't able to be kept alive, it could put at risk the entire existence of life on this planet. I mean, that's how I see it. I mean, to me, it's a huge thing because of who the people here are, and the power of this land, and how ancient it is, and how long they've been successfully maintaining the true meaning of being people here for so long,
yeah,
longer than anywhere else. And they're hanging on by a thread, you know, and what we're doing is trying to discover and help to maintain. And, you know, the fact that we're having this conversation now, I think is actually, it's quite scary though too, isn't it?
Oh, look, I mean, it's easy to go into the fear of it because sometimes, you know, if we look around, you know, my my question is always, where's the love? Where is the love and where's the truth? And so when you see the masses, you know, going in this direction of influence that has nothing to do with sustainable connection, with any connection, you know, and that I think you're right. It comes right down to this knowledge retaining the sense of connection, but also the responsibilities that go with it. Because there's a felt connection, but then there's also these original instructions that were given to humans just because we're humans. It kind of comes with the territory of being alive.
Yes.
That we can't destroy that which gives us life, and
yes,
yet we're doing it.
And yes.
How did that ever come about? And so many indigenous elders, I remember the people who came from Colombia, the elders who came. It's like, how did this happen? Even Bob said, when the colonizers first came, they can't be humans. Humans don't behave this way. You know, on the one hand, you've got the British colonizers saying, there's only flora and fauna here. And then on the other hand, you've got the Aboriginal people saying, these can't be humans. So each culture had a different perception of what comes with being human.
Yes. Well,
and for Aboriginal people, over tens of thousands of years, you know, the results of their humanity was sustained beauty.
Absolutely.
Nothing was destroyed beyond the level it could replace itself.
Yes.
And then in just 200 plus years of colonization, the British imposition of their humanity,
yes,
has caused vast destruction. And that, you know, with globalization, what we're seeing is, and what people are finally waking up to, is what they're doing in India is relevant to me right here.
Absolutely.
This is what the Colombian elders said decades ago when they put out their first film, From the Heart of the World.
Yes.
They said, what you're doing is, we can feel it on our mountain. Wake up. Wake up, world.
Well,
wake up, humanity.
Let me ask you this. Is it possible that the fundamental foundation or premises upon which modern military industrial civilization, that the most fundamental stuff that this is all built on, is completely at odds with the eternal dreamtime law? That we might be impossible for us to live in civilization like this and still be people. Can it be resolved?
I'm certainly not a spokesperson for, you know, the existential reality of life, but I do believe, and Bob did teach, that opposites walk together in life. There's a dark side and there's a light side. There's good and there's bad. And I'll never forget when I first met him and we were at a gathering in Perth, and these two women were there, sisters, and they were family to Bob, and they were kind of having a little bit of fun with me, and they could see that, you know, there was something between me and Bob. And at any rate, so they were teaching me little bits, little things, and they said, you know, for us, Bob, everything's black or white. There's no gray. It's either right or wrong. And it's so true. It's very clear. And so that opposite energy that destroys the things that keep us alive, that does exist. And it will continue to raise its ugly head and have its way as long as we don't rise up and act against it. We have to every individual is in a position of either supporting it or dissociating from contributing to that energy in any way. And sometimes that means standing up. And, you know, what comes to mind is something that Grandmother Redleaf, Cherokee elder, said to me. She said, Barbara, and you know, as a caveat, I know that one of the purposes of being human is that we're born to create. We are a co-creative presence on this planet. When we do something, that's we're supposed to create. And she said, Barbara, you know, we have three choices. If we choose something, something's created. If we don't choose something, if we choose, no, I'm not going to do that, something's created. But when we choose not to choose, nothing is created. It's a state of inertia, Jeff. And if we live in that state where we simply go on our merry way in the lucky country or wherever we happen to be comfortable.
Yes.
And we don't take action in the presence of this other juggernaut that is having its way with the planet and taking the resources and raping Mother Earth and doing all kinds of things, it will have its way. That's what's happening.
Yes, the marketers will be glad to make those choices for you on our behalf.
Well, each of us has a choice.
Yes.
About how we respond to that. And Grandmother Redleaf is saying, respond. So you create something. Make a choice. What do you want to create? What do you want to contribute to? You want to contribute to that continuation of, you know, that mechanical world that's polluting the water, that's poisoning the air? Or do you want to create the original connection to the earth on behalf of, in service to, the children who follow us?
Well, now let me ask you this. Did you ever hear of, it's a very interesting book by an American guy living on King Island named Robert Lawler. It's called Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime. And I don't know, we might have talked about that before, and despite it being very much of kind of a Eurocentric perspective, he does have some interesting things to say, you know, like, but the thing of like waking up and every day is like it's the first day of creation. And that's kind of like, you know, that kind of relates.
Well, that is a key part of what my husband's practice was.
Really?
Which was a welcome mother-son ceremony he used to do. And as long as he saw that sun, you know, he knew it was a new day.
Yes.
And he was told even, you know, by this tree that nursed him back to health when he was beaten so badly in the mission that he could barely walk. And he crawled underneath a tree and he asked it to hold him. It was as if the tree said to him, my son, this will pass.
And I know how the tree's voice probably sounded kind of like this. Bob, this is your grandmother tree, and I love you.
I can see...
He used to look to the sun, you know, and in his tradition, mother sun and mother earth are sisters.
Yes.
And he had many mothers. And it's that sisterhood that's part of the traditional way that is, you know, both of them are required to provide the nurturing that we need for life.
Yes.
That we need, that all life needs.
Yes. Well,
and there's a naturalness in that natural law of the sun coming up.
Yes.
Every day that brought him great comfort and great hope.
It does me too. I play my flute and burn my sage to the sun when she comes up and goes down. And
yeah.
I call her...
It takes both. But
yes.
But see, the thing is, Jeff, we're meant to be that.
Yes.
That's our template as women. And, you know, in Bob's way, the moon was the male energy.
Yes.
And that too has, there are many teachings with that in terms of that moon that reflects the light of the sun.
Yes.
You see?
Absolutely.
And
yes,
the moon controls all the fluids. Well, how else are you going to get procreation?
Absolutely.
If there's not that lure.
Yes.
you know, not that magnetic pull.
Yes. Well, look.
And so all the teachings, they're there in nature.
Yes. Well, let me ask you this. As you understand the entirety of the First Nations, as a continental community, going back before Europeans were here, or how it's changed into what everybody is now, is there any sort of motif or cosmological element that would be common to everyone? Because, like, I'm thinking of something called the rainbow serpent. I know it's not universal, but it's shared by a lot of different nations, as I understand it. But I'm just asking if there might be, because one of a fallacy, and I saw in Robert Lawler's work, was he would say, like, well, Aboriginal people this and Aboriginal people that. And I go, like, but look, that's a pretty sweeping generalization to refer to many, many hundreds of different language groups and cultures, and to talk about them as one thing. And for certain things, it might be true. But I'm just, if you see what I'm saying, because I know every language group and every culture and every nation is a unique cosmology, each of which could be as rich and diverse as, like, the Bible, for example. And when we lose the last elder that knew that language, it's like all that is just kind of evaporated into the to try to gain what some of the most important. I mean, would you say, is there anything, what would be something that would be other than the connection with the earth and the ancestors and stuff? In other words, would the Dreamtime Law, fundamentally interpreted, would it be the same for all the nations?
I don't know that I can speak to that specifically, because that was not Bob's language.
Yes.
But he did talk about the common thread of oneness.
Yes.
That there, and the reverence for all life that goes with the self-perception as being part of that oneness. So that oneness transcends the physical. That oneness includes the ancestors who are still here on the land. It includes the goanna and the python and the kangaroo and the tree and the air and the water.
And the platypus?
It includes all of that. And in that oneness, I am that. And that is me. I am that grain of sand. That grain of sand is me. I am. That's one of Bob's ceremonies. And so I would say, from what he described, that was a universal principle that he never saw any deviation from that. And I would say that in all the indigenous people I met throughout the world when I was traveling with Bob, when we were together, they have the same value and perception of how each one of us, how every being fits in to the greater cosmology of the universe, of creation, manifest and unmanifest. That oneness is it. And it doesn't matter what little details differ. It doesn't matter what language you speak, what color skin you have, what dances you know, what beads you wear. None of that matters. When you live with that knowing, then you hurt the water and you hurt yourself. You do the wrong thing to that, and you're doing it to yourself. And so it doesn't exist. You know, all of that contamination never accumulated. Because if you accidentally do the wrong thing, you simply make it right straight away, within 3 days. You just make it right. And